Chapter 6. Father and Brother in the Lublin Prison. On a Friday morning in December of 1941, my brother and I went out to clean the snow from the front of the house. Suddenly we saw the dog of the Gestapo chief, Fischer, in the distance. We knew that a four-legged harasser trained to attack Jews was inevitably followed by a two-legged one. My brother said quietly, "Let's go. This time they're looking for me." The night before, another big raid had taken place. Many Poles, among them our neighbour, the former Fischer officer Borkowski, and some Jews had been arrested. We knew that while arresting one person, the Gestapo liked to take along close relatives as well, regardless of whether guilty or innocent. Every arrest by the Gestapo meant certain torture and death. I did not know how my brother was connected with the raid, or with the arrested Borkowski, nor which charges were being brought against him, such as reading and distributing underground papers. I knew, however, that he and Borkowski were friends, and often had spoken with each other. My brother must have been, for another reason, a thorn in the Gestapo's eyes. He was tall, broad-shouldered, strong, and abounded in good health. He was the opposite of the typical Jew, as described in the Stürmer, the slanderous anti-Semitic newspaper. My brother's physical appearance contradicted the Nazis' racial theory. That was enough reason to eliminate any such Jew. After catching sight of the Gestapo dog, we both ran away and hid in a barn. We were told later that the SD official Adolf Deckhoff, an ethnic German of gruesome character and a well-known Jew killer, proceeded with two other SD officials and the dog directly to our apartment. This took place a few weeks after my father's arrest. Both my mother and sister Edessa were sick and in bed. The SD men asked for my brother, then demolished everything within their reach, and left an order that my brother, Meyer, must report to the Gestapo no later than Monday at 7 o'clock. Adolf Dickhoff and his colleagues then went to the house of the Judenrat, called together all the members present at that time, and repeated his command that my brother appear the next Monday morning at 7 before the Gestapo. If the order was not obeyed, the entire Judenrat, 12 members, and 100 Jews from the town would be shot. This order was a grave misfortune for the town's Jewish population, and especially for our family. The alternatives we faced were horrible. Either we had to deliver my brother to his murderers, or have the death of 112 men on our consciences, not to mention the suffering of the widows and orphans. Several members of the Judenrat and the Jewish police soon came to our house. Some of them implored, some threatened, others pitied us. Friends, relatives, Torah scholars, all of them wanted to help, but none knew how. Nobody doubted the seriousness of the threat. That evening after dark, we left our hiding place in the barn. My brother found a safer one in the attic of Eli Chaim Tenenbaum's house. I hid close to our apartment in the Elder Kaschmacher's house, from where I could watch the entrance to our apartment through an attic window. In this situation, my brother also had to hide from the Jewish police. I, however, sneaked into our place at night to be with my mother and sister. We sat in the dim light with the shutters closed, believing that together we could bear our suffering more easily. On that unforgettably long Friday, my mother lit the Sabbath candles as usual, and following Jewish custom, covered her eyes to say the prayer. The silence was broken by my weeping and sighs. My two sisters, my brother-in-law, their child, and I stood helplessly around the table with heads hanging and tears in our eyes. We were five tortured, helpless, and worried people who could only be saved by God. It took a long time after the prayer for my mother to uncover her eyes. Her face was no longer the same. Her eyes were swollen and red. They expressed what was going on inside her. There was so much she had to pray for. Today I still choke on my tears when I think of it. I wanted to be allowed to cry then, but I had to remain strong. We felt as if we had all been sentenced to death, and then had to wait our execution. The room was filled with a deadly silence. Each one of us sat immersed in his thoughts. Only the ticking of the clock and the pounding of our hearts were audible. A quick death would have been a relief. It was cruel enough when the Gestapo picked up its victims, but at least one did not have to blame oneself. It was our misfortune to be chosen and thereby punished further when we had to deliver our victims ourselves. The beast did not only want our blood, he wanted to be served by us as well. We received my brother's death sentence, by registered mail, from the Gestapo with an ultimatum. The ultimatum was to run out in 72 hours. We only had that much time to think. To live with this knowledge, that was the tragedy of my mother and my family. I cannot describe my brother's feelings. I only know that he did not want to decide alone, and waited for the counsel and help of the family. Early Monday morning, my mother, my two sisters, and I went to Meyer's hiding place. My mother suffered the most, not only because of her maternal feelings, but more because her son insisted upon a decision from her and was willing to obey her unconditionally. During our visit, no one offered advice or discussed anything. Instead, we just enjoyed the moment looking at each other and feeling together. That was our hunger, which had to be appeased at that moment. It was an indescribable consolation in such a horrendous situation. Our eyes filled with tears of sorrow and joy, sorrow over our separation, and the joy of just being together, if only momentarily. We ignored the future, even if it was only for a few moments. We looked at each other continually as we hugged and kissed. My mother managed to utter the words expected of her. "My child, I do not know what you should do, but whatever you decide, may God be with you." I am sure that these words were not planned. They simply were the extemporaneous expression of her thoughts at that moment. We embraced and kissed. No one was able to speak. It was the last time that we were to embrace and kiss. Only Father was missing. He was in jail, but soon other members of our family would be missing. My brother arose, left his hideout, and went to the barber. He had his head shaved in order to avoid the first part of the Gestapo's routine. From there, he went to the Gestapo. He was 27 years old. We never saw him again. After a short time, he was transferred to the castle prison at Lublin, along with Chaim Diamant, Isser Sonnenschein, and many others. My father and brother were in the same prison, but my father did not know it. There was a chance that we might see our father again, but as we knew, there was no hope for my brother. I know today that he was tortured mercilessly. We continued our attempts to liberate my father. We managed to contact him. Some prison guards smuggled messages to him. To conceal my brother's arrest from my father, I signed the messages with my brother's name. After work, I spent all night writing letters to Dr. Hofmokel Ostrovsky, prominent lawyer of German origin. I hardly slept. I spent each night thinking and dreaming. Ostrovsky's letters were short and few. He was our only hope, and at least he showed understanding for our situation, which in turn encouraged me to write more letters. The day of my father's trial finally arrived. He was accused of smuggling cigarettes. The fact that he was a Jew was not emphasized, which was fortunate for us. The trial was held in Lublin, but we could travel there only with special permission. I will never forget the night before the trial. I was reared in a traditional Jewish Zionist household, but we were not particularly religious. That night I did nothing except read Psalms. I had to do something, and I could think of nothing better or more appropriate. My knowledge of Hebrew was sufficient to understand most of the text. I did not only read, I prayed, sobbed, implored, and swore at every single word. This was my way of praying to God. I did not want to lose my father. As a kind of compensation for the head of my brother, the elder of the Jews provided my mother and sister with special permission to travel to Lublin for the trial. It was mid-February, cold and icy. My mother and sister travelled in a state of complete desperation. As though it weren't enough, in Lublin my mother slipped on the icy street and broke her hand. Despite the intense pain, she still managed to attend the trial. My father was sentenced to 4 months in prison, but because of Mr. Ostrovsky's connections, he was released from serving the remainder of the sentence, 2 to 3 weeks. The lawyer asked my mother who had written the impressive letters. My father returned with mother. Our happiness was overwhelming. Even greater was the sensational news that a Jew had returned alive and well from a German prison. Relatives and acquaintances came with congratulations. It was a happy event in a time of predominant sorrow. I thought about the numerous letters I had written, which actually were meant as a prayer to God, but were directed to the lawyer, who understood them correctly. It had been exceedingly difficult, but it had not been in vain. It was 1942, shortly after the decisions of the conference in Wannsee had started to make themselves felt. The former Nazi method of torturing Jews to death was replaced by capital punishment in accordance with the Endlösung. The first mass execution, according to the new rules, was supposed to take place in the Castle Prison of Lublin. As far as I remember, witnesses reported that on February 17, 1942, all or the majority of the Jews imprisoned there were brought together and shot. According to the same testimony, my brother was also shot on that day. Only one day before, on February 16, 1942, my father was released without knowing that his son was in the same prison. We at home could only cry over the rescue of my father and the loss of my brother.